Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalka.
And this is Core Intuition, some weird private API. This episode is sponsored by Zendesk and Linode.
All right, Manton. Well, last week we got back into our groove of answering listener Q&A, and I thought this week we should just jump right back in because we're lucky to have a great question here from the user Blackpawn on our Slack team. And they ask, it's hard to keep up in the App Store as a solo dev. Maybe a good topic for a future episode would be tips on exploiting your competitive advantage as a solo slash indie developer. Certainly one advantage is cost. Running a one-person business, you can afford to price more aggressively than bigger players. What other ways might an indie use their smaller size to their advantage?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing that always comes to mind for me is smaller teams can just move more quickly, especially super small teams like one person, because you don't need meetings, you don't need to talk about things to death. You can make a decision, move on, actually code it, implement it. I've long said and talked about and written posts about just how quick you can move if you control everything from like the server API to the iOS app to just, yeah, making decisions and implementing and moving on. So I think that's a huge advantage that indies have.
Yeah.
However, there's also some problems in that you're only one person or a couple people. And I mean, I've been running into this lately of I don't have the resources to do a lot of almost grunt work sometimes that is getting in my way, like sysadmin kind of work in some cases, or even coding, like non-creative kind of programming work where it's like, I know it needs to be done, but I just can't take the time to do it. And having even a small team where you could delegate some of that stuff, I think that is an advantage to slightly bigger companies or even much bigger companies where they can have people that's like, I've got time to automate this thing that is holding you up, or, you know, code this thing. I mean, I've been running into this a lot lately where I get hung up on very easy problems to solve, but just not having the time to get them actually done.
Yeah. The advantage that comes to my mind, kind of dovetailing with what you said, well, as usual, I'm going to make a little bit of a tangent here, but I read this quote recently. It was, I think, Barack Obama reacting to, you know, the sort of like common suggestion that like they should run government more like a startup, or like, you know, if Silicon Valley tech executives got into government, they could like really shape things up. Mm-hmm. And his response was something like, government has to be like deliberate and exhaustive because it has to represent and accommodate the goals of, you know, the needs of everybody. What comes to mind for me is there's sort of like a spectrum probably of efficiency versus, or there's like an axis of efficiency versus like breadth of concern. Mm-hmm. And for example, at the very, you know, top level of US government, you do have like, oh my gosh, you know, every little thing that happens has to go through, you know, I only know from an abstract point of view, but you know, you got like bills that go through Congress and they have to be signed and, you know, they're reviewed and everybody's editing them all the time, putting their own thoughts in, trying to get their own points of view represented. Then they're debated and, you know, maybe they're passed like in one form and then revised later. And it's like super deliberate and super slow and super inefficient. I think most people would agree, but it's inefficient for a reason, that, you know, and sort of Obama's comments, I think, kind of got at that. And then like on that spectrum, go down to like the Silicon Valley level, like big company like Apple or Facebook or Google or Twitter. And those, that's like the example that's being held up as like, well, we could run government as efficiently as Apple. Look how well off we'd be. But like, even within Apple compared to an indie, boy, you know, we get frustrated as indie developers with some of the shortcomings in the OS and the App Store and all this stuff. And a huge part of why that stuff isn't changing, I think, is exactly like comparable inefficiencies that are sort of like there for a reason. They're there to satisfy this like greater problem Apple has, which is it needs to it needs to represent like the greater vision of the company without, you know, being led by the whim of any individuals or even any small groups. So if you want to do something at Apple, you know, there's little things you can get away with here and there, I'm sure. But if you want to do something big at Apple, you've got to get, you know, not only like some of your peers to sign off on it, you got to get your management chain to sign off on it. And depending on how significant it is, all the way up the chain. And then you've got like this massive group of people working on things, hashing out what the right way to do something is. Meanwhile, Manton, if you want snippets to work one way, you might have to think it over in the shower or something. The efficiency of the intrinsic efficiency of shower decisions. But you know, you make the call, and for better or for worse, and often for better and for worse, we as indies, small time, you know, companies can make decisions, execute them, observe the results, and then iterate on that in a way that is just simply, it would, to be fair, it would be reckless and irresponsible for a bigger company to operate that way.
Right. And there's something when you get to that scale of a bigger company, there's just like problems become not just problems, but like kind of like company ending doom, like for security and privacy is a big one, right? So like if I have a problem because I moved a little too quickly and there was a security bug in one of my apps, it would be really bad. I would feel terrible, especially if any of my users' data was compromised. But I have a very limited number of users. Whereas like, you know, if Yahoo, like millions of, you know, email passwords are leaked or something like that, that's huge. Like that, it's a different scale where you absolutely have to be deliberate, like you said, and go slowly and pay more attention to those kind of things. And that slows the process down. And I think this is a challenge for indies is like, especially, I mean, every day, you know, there's new, not every day, but frequently new security problems, even at the level of affecting the election right now in the United States. And I do think we need to be more and more mindful of this and be a little more deliberate and careful. And sometimes that might mean slowing down and hiring someone, security expert or someone, to like make sure that we're doing things correctly. But we can still be efficient. We can still make decisions in the shower and move quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth, getting back to the question, what are the advantages? I think it's worth acknowledging that there are whole classes of business opportunity that are effectively off limits to bigger companies because the like the investment slash payoff doesn't make sense on a large scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like, and I think, for example, something like a blogging app, just to pick a random example out of thin air, is probably an example of that because, you know, like we had Microsoft in the business and they pulled out, I think, in part because they realized like it kind of wasn't, there wasn't a big enough demand to make it worth a big company's attention. And I think that's something we can really be inspired by if we sort of step back a little bit and look at the business landscape, not as what can I compete with in general, but what business opportunities exist that by definition, none of the big companies even want to be a part of.
That's a great point. And I think it's also interesting to think about like what, like if you do accidentally compete with a big business, do you fall into that, you know, famous, like, is this a feature of Apple's iCloud or is this a full product in the case right. of Dropbox versus Steve Jobs from years ago. And that's kind of okay, but I think you do need to acknowledge that and kind of evaluate, is this the case? So you can move more quickly than a big company. You can tackle problems that make a lot of money for you, but have absolutely no effect. Like Apple would not care about that kind of money at all. It's so small for them.
Right.
But at the same time, kind of being aware of, this isn't necessarily something that can just be kind of consumed as a small bullet point in someone else's huge app. And I, you know, it's not obvious sometimes, but blogging software, I think, is a great example. It's something that people need, people that are passionate about writing on the web. And it can never exactly be just sucked into, like, I don't know, Safari or iCloud or something like that. It's hard to imagine something, if a feature like that is sucked into a larger app, it will never have the attention that passionate writers deserve, right? It'll never have the features. It'll never have it. I mean, RSS actually is not a terrible example. Like when RSS became mainstream in larger apps, that was fine. But people who really cared about reading blogs and demanded kind of more features still wanted to go to third-party apps or indie developers.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, another way of, we've kind of gotten sidetracked on this question of, small versus large, but I like this sidetrack. So I think we can indulge it a little bit. Something I heard recently on the talk show with Ben Thompson, I think, and John Gruber, was they were talking about the average revenue that many big companies make per employee, and like, you know, they were sort of going from the bottom of the ranks up through the tops, and one of the most impressive numbers I remember they cited was I believe they cited $2 million per employee for Apple.
Wow.
In revenue.
Wow.
And that's per year. And I think it was something like $500,000 profit. This is more out of thin air, so I might be even more wrong about this, but the scale is approximately right. So if you take something like that for Apple's scale, something that you and I would put together would have to be have a revenue as individuals of $2 million per year to justify it being a type of market that you know, and that doesn't even scale. But just like, so in other words, if you've got something that you do on your own and you quote unquote only have revenue of $400,000 a year, you're still like way down in the not interested zone. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. That's just kind of like a little bit of a touchstone for me to now think about, like, you know, obviously, profit is more important than revenue, but by the same token, I think it was like $500,000 profit. And Apple's obviously an exceptional case, but it was something like $500,000 profit per employee. And,
well, and for an indie, like the difference between revenue and profit is not that extreme usually.
Yeah,
like our costs as a one person company are usually not $1.5 million. you know, it's our costs are fairly. If you run a server, yes, you have costs, and of course you have other little costs. But for the most part, you don't have like orders of magnitude difference between revenue and profit. They're more comparable.
Right. Yeah, and so if you have $200,000 revenue, you're probably doing pretty good by most people's standards, and so demonstrates a pretty big gap between what you and I would think was a pretty darn good, and this doesn't just apply to individuals. Like if you had a 5-person team, and you were making $1 million in revenue, I think you'd consider yourself doing pretty well. The costs do start to go up, of course, with, you know, you start having, probably you want to have some kind of like healthcare plan and stuff like that. But of course you're paying for that. Most of us are paying for that anyway, unless we have a deal through a spouse or something. But you know, I guess I think that's the key is if we examine this, there are not only advantages to, or I guess I should say, maybe it's not so much that there are advantages to being an indie. It's just that the opportunities are much different. Because there are, like you said, opening up, there are huge downsides to being an indie as well. But the other way of looking at that is those are just non-opportunities. Like, you know, making an app that reasonably requires 20 people to work on it is a non-opportunity. Right? Don't go that way if you want to be a small-time indie developer. You know, like don't run a social network, I would say. It's probably a good idea.
I don't know. I might run a social network anyway. No, you're right, though. There's certain, you know, sometimes I was going to say we, but I'll speak for myself. Sometimes I fall into the trap of thinking that just because it's just code and I know how to write it, that doesn't necessarily mean I can compete with a 500-person company. I do think it means that I can compete with a 20, 30, 50-person company. But
yes,
at some point, there are problems that do require more people. I think Twitter has way too many employees, probably. But you do need a certain level, a size of staff to be able to get to that scale.
Yeah. Yeah, it was actually, I don't know if you listened to that recent episode of the talk show, but that was
I'm only like halfway through. Yeah.
They were talking about Twitter's employee count, and that's sort of what led to this discussion. And unfortunately, Twitter's revenue and profit per employee are not as impressive as Apple's.
Sure.
But, you know, and I'm not trying to bag on Twitter per se, but just to say, like, you run into these problems and you have a ton of employees, you really have to justify the employees sooner or later with money. And here's something I think most of us who consider ourselves above average, I mean, this is a funny thing, like, everybody considers themselves above average, like, whatever they do, but let's face it, most of us have worked with people who we felt were not carrying their weight. And this seems to be a natural side effect of largeness in a company. Like, it seems to me that you can't get past a certain size without starting to accumulate people who don't pull their weight. And I think there's also and maybe this is healthier psychologically and, you know, work balance and all that, but I think there's also a tendency to sort of like maybe settle into a slightly less intense work ethic sometimes. And for whatever that's worth, I know that's kind of a loaded allegation, but for whatever that's worth, like, you as an individual, if we just go back to speaking about this in terms of advantages, you have full control over how much work actually goes into it, you know? And so if you've ever worked at a job where, you know, or I can say from personal experience that as an indie, I've had days, many days where, oh, it turns out I only really did like 2 hours of work. And, although it may be difficult to overcome that challenge and like actually put more time in than that sometimes, it is ultimately down to us. And I think that big companies sort of have to factor in on average, you know, on average in a big company, somebody's having a 2-hour workday, right? Like, and maybe all of us are, maybe sometimes, maybe it's just on average, that's the way it works out. But I sort of cling to this hope that when it comes down to it, I can get more out of my day on average as a one-person indie than a 100-person company can on average for, you know, 100 people.
Yeah, that sounds fair. I think the that smallish size of company too is pretty fascinating to me. And when you were talking about like the average, you know, amount of revenue per Apple employee, I was trying to think of like, well, what's another smaller company than Apple, but bigger company than you and I? And one that I've always been fascinated with is this company called Buffer, which we actually use on the jobs board, but they do, you know, like cross-posting to Twitter and Facebook, for example. And the reason I've been so fascinated is they share their revenue like openly every month. And currently, it looks like they have about $1 million a month in revenue. So roughly 12 million, you know, a year. And they have 80 employees, right? So it comes out to whatever, I don't know, some over 100,000 per employee, probably closer to 150 or higher, which is kind of in line with what I would expect from a smaller company. Not a huge company, but much bigger than you and I. And so, I don't know, I like looking at these like medium-ish companies, because especially if they seem like they're on the right track, because I think we can learn a lot. And that feels kind of write to me. I'm sure they want to do better. I'm sure they want more cash in the bank or whatever. But because they share all this kind of thing, you can kind of see like, okay, what's a company that's been around for a few years that has 50 to 100 people? Like, what are they kind of aiming for in terms of revenue?
Well, I found a link to something. I don't know if it's the same thing that John and Ben were referencing, but I found a Business Insider link that has a rundown of a bunch. I think it's the top 12, you know, revenue per employee, and it starts with number 12, IBM at $244,000 per employee.
Okay,
and then goes down to Apple. Like I said, almost $2 million per employee, and then Google actually at just over, you know, well, over $1 million per employee. So Google and Apple are both doing real well money-wise. but yeah, you know, I guess back on topic, just I think that's something to the takeaway is look at the specific things. I think you could almost answer this question for yourself if you look at specific issues that a big company faces and then ask, how would an indie face that same issue? And for some of the issues, if you can deduce, oh, well, the indie would have a totally easier time. HR, totally easier time, right? And for some of them, it would be a much more difficult time, like cutting deals with major music publishers. Terrible time, right? You and I shouldn't go into, maybe you can go into the social network business, but you and I shouldn't go into the you know, Spotify business.
Probably not. Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting way to sort of just focus on what should you be doing as an indie is to kind of continue to ask yourself, like, well, how would a big company handle this and how can I handle it better? And if you can't handle it better than a big company, maybe switch the focus of the product so that you can. All right, we're happy to have back sponsoring the show this week, Zendesk. Flawless apps are like flawless people. They exist in theory, but hey, I've never seen one. But while we can be forgiving with our in-laws, flaws in your app can easily make or break your success unless you have the right safeguards in place. In most apps, mobile customer service is just a contact us link that launches an email. This makes it difficult for users to get help, leading to wasted time and frustration. The Zendesk Embeddables Mobile SDK brings native in-app support. Users can view self-service content and submit tickets right from within your app. Best of all, it's quick to implement and is included with Zendesk at no extra charge. Learn more at zendesk.com/coreint.
Yeah, so I've been using Zendesk for all my support for a couple years, and I really like the workflow. I really like having a system that is beyond just email. I'm not perfect with customer support sometimes, but I want to be perfect, and having a tool like this really helps me. And so a couple months ago when the SDK came out, I tried it out. I put it in the beta version of one of my apps, and it's very easy to integrate. You add the SDK, and what I like about it is it's not just like you have to go all in and add every feature possible. You can pick and choose what you want. So if you just want the user to be able to submit a support ticket directly from your app, without having to go to email or figure out a contact link or something like that, you can do that. If you want the user to be able to check on existing support tickets directly within your app, you add the view controller for that, right? If you want them to be able to look at knowledge base articles that you manage in Zendesk, you can add that. So you can kind of pick and choose. You can allow people to anonymously submit support tickets. Or if you know in your app who the user already is, you can kind of authenticate them that way. And so they just it's less work for them to have to type anything in except the actual question or feedback they have. So thanks to Zendesk for sponsoring the show. You can check out Zendesk and, of course, the mobile SDK for your iPhone app at zendesk.com/coreint. So, Daniel, every once in a while we talk about the Apple Car because it's just such a wild idea to me still. For Apple to do this, that it's worth talking about and seeing, kind of trying to figure out how, what it says about the company, what it says about all Apple fans like us who are following everything. And I think the way we wrapped this up a handful of episodes ago was, well, I know I was really skeptical. I really thought it was kind of stupid, but I didn't think the idea of Apple doing something with cars, you know, some kind of software, more on CarPlay. You know, I thought that was a good direction, but the whole, like, building a car just seemed, like, completely unrealistic, especially the first rumors we heard a year or more ago where they would actually come out with a new car soon, like within the next couple of years. And so now we know there's another Bloomberg article that hit this week that says basically, no, this is really scaled back. They are not going to, in fact, build a car anytime soon. They've still got a bunch of people working on this stuff, but way, way scaled back, which to me is correct. Like, I mean, I don't want people to be laid off at Apple, certainly, but it just still does not fit with my, you know, kind of how I imagine the company for them to actually make and ship a car. They should still work on software, though.
I mean, I guess we're not going to get an Apple car within 5 years. That was considered pretty optimistic, even when people were assuming that things were like scaling up and they were really jumping into this. Mm-hmm. However, I sort of share the concerns. I think John Gruber on Daring Fireball said something like, you know, it's not really Apple's style to just like make part of the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to envision what kind of solution Apple would have. You know, like, for example, Apple doesn't license Siri out to other people just because it's, like, you know, a pretty good assistant. What kinds of technologies, if Apple's going to keep working on cars, what would they do with that if they're not going to actually make the car to put it in?
Well, I think that the obvious thing is make CarPlay better and make it more widespread, make it available in just normal cars that people want to buy.
Yeah.
And I you don't need to stop there. You don't need to, just because you do that doesn't mean that's the end of the story. Like, you could do CarPlay, you could make it so significantly better than any other car's touchscreen interface that after a few years, it's not a standard, but it is, you know, loved and widespread. And then you can still make a car. Like, nothing's stopping you from making a car.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying and what John Gruber was saying, but I don't think Apple has to be like that for everything. I don't think they have to make the hardware and the software for every single product they make. And, like, I mean, you said, like, well, like the Siri example, well, maybe they should open Siri up. Maybe they should license it to other people. I mean, we get so caught now with, like, the big companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon. They have this narrow vision of where we have to do everything, and there's no interoperability, there's no open APIs between anything, and I think that's not the way forward. I think at some point some of this stuff should be more open.
Well, and I sort of glossed over, I think, the very example that we talked about last time, we talked about, you know, whether Apple should do a whole car or not. We talked about the Apple TV and how, you know, that's a very good example of Apple selling, yes, it's hardware, but it's hardware that is useless without a significant third-party hardware to couple it with.
Yeah.
And CarPlay in that sense is very comparable. I think last time we talked about it, I argued that Apple should still build the whole car because, you know, then they would be in a position to make sure that every car meets the standard for what they want CarPlay to be able to do. But they clearly don't have that luxury with TVs, and maybe that comparison is more apt than, you know, it's sort of the only comparison that comes to mind. So, like, it's sort of the most apt comparison, I think, because it's the only comparison. I can't think of another thing off the top of my head that's just, like, kind of useless without coupling it to a larger hardware device or a more expensive hardware device. But it might be more apt anyway because so many people already own a TV. So the idea of selling a new TV to somebody is kind of an uphill battle. And that same argument, I guess, works for cars as well because cars are very similar. Mm-hmm. Most people already own a car. And people do buy new cars, but they buy new cars the way they buy new TVs, which is like every 5 to 10 years or when they break, right?
Yeah, it's not like a phone or even a computer, but especially a phone where people frequently buy new phones every 2 years. Of course, many people every year, but it's every couple of years is extremely common. You absolutely do not want to trade in your car that often. It would take a long time for them to ramp up. I mean, just look at Tesla. They do almost everything right, and it's taken 10 years for them to even just be in the position of kind of having a mainstream offering.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, I'm my mind jumped also to a company like Automattic, you know, the 1T Automattic.
Yeah.
Not the WordPress company, but the company that makes the little gadget that goes in your car.
Yeah.
I don't think Apple TV, I mean, I don't think CarPlay has any link to that sort of onboard computer. I might be wrong about that. Do you happen to know?
I don't know, but that's a great example because the way Automattic works, my understanding, is it plugs into a standard, right?
It's
like something that lots of car makers have, and we need more of that, right?
Yeah.
And absolutely, CarPlay should plug into that. It seems like it would be really interesting to have that kind of those kind of statistics tracked by, you know, Apple software.
Yeah.
But we need more of that kind of stuff. Like if Apple can't make CarPlay great, they should work closely with other car makers to have more standards like that that would make... I mean, I would love to be able to buy any old car and just pop off the dashboard LCD screen and, like, buy a, you know, couple hundred or even more, you know, few hundred dollar, even 500. I mean, you could charge a lot for these things. You could maybe as much computer. Buy from Apple. Maybe it's $800 or something, even $1,000. Buy it from Apple and then just plug it in.
Keep going, Manton.
Yeah. I would spend $2,000. But you know what I mean? Like, if I could, that's a significant upgrade for my car. If I could just pop off the screen that I hate and put in one from Apple that's just perfect and it just plugs into all the parts of a car that it needs to. I mean, that would be great. I think more standards like that would be really interesting, and there'd be more innovation in terms of car UI if we had that kind of interoperability.
Right. So you got the Mac for your desk, the iPhone for your pocket, the watch for your wrist, and the CarPlay for your car. It is a whole new product, you know, market segment that's huge, and I think you're right, could be in that similar kind of like several hundred dollar consumer electronic high profit margin zone.
Yeah, I think you could do a lot with that. And it's not, I mean, it's almost like maybe they should think about it. You know, we talk about the Amazon Echo and of course Google's new Google Home device and Apple should have something like that. But it's not really unlike that where it's like, I've upgraded my kitchen by buying a $200 device.
Yeah.
And I'd like to do the same kind of thing for my car. And you could do things with that. I mean, it could have better microphones in it, for example.
Yeah.
You could do a lot with that, I think. Mm. And of course, right now it's impossible. They have to work much more closely with car manufacturers, but I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, you spoke about the standard of, you know, the little port that the Automattic device plugs into. But yeah, the truth is, although it's not like a fixed standard, the sizes of in-dash stereo systems, I think, is fairly standard because there is a lucrative sort of aftermarket stereo business.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's one of those things where I think, unfortunately, it would still be like it's at a level where most people would have to have it installed by a professional. But that doesn't mean it's not viable. And so it would be kind of interesting if Apple was like, hey, if they sort of declared defeat with CarPlay as a partnership and just said, hey, we make all the CarPlays now.
I think you could do both. Yeah. Because like there's some, I mean, what I imagined where you just like pop this thing off. I mean, some car companies like, there's no way we're going to ever do anything like that because it would be clunky and it would just be weird. But I think you could do both. You could, I don't know. The point is, I don't know if that's correct. Maybe that's a stupid idea, but there's so many things that might be correct. There's so many different paths this could take that would be interesting, but they're still short of a car, short of making your own car.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you got me wondering when Apple is going to buy Automattic. Because it seems like it's right up their alley.
One interest is I'm looking on the Automattic site, and it's funny, it doesn't work with electric cars, which I guess
Oh, they don't have that port.
I guess they don't have that port. And also, I think some things that automatic tracks are irrelevant.
Like gas.
Exactly. Like, I think that's one of the big selling points, is having better understanding of that stuff. But I don't know. It feels like you could do a lot. If you could just plug anything into your car, it seems like you could do a lot. That thing you plug in could have GPS. That thing that you plug in could have, 3G wireless. That thing you plug in could have, better microphone. I don't know. It seems like you could. I'd love to have the point where I could upgrade my car easily without having to go get another car loan or lease or, go through the hassle of talking to some sales guy. I'd love to be able to do some small upgrades over the years.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff that, I don't have one of these automatics, but I've heard their ads quite a bit on shows like, ATP. And I always think, even though I'm not a frequent driver, I always think, like, that would be cool. And there's stuff like that that without a device like automatic today, there are workflows that are totally in line with Apple's vision for how your devices should work. Like with Apple Home in particular, they have these integrations with automatic and like go through if this, then that, and turn your lights on when you're coming home.
Yeah.
Currently, that's, currently I think Apple can still do a lot of that kind of stuff because you've also got an iPhone in your pocket, but there's specific things that, knowing that it's your car could be handy. And I could see anything from maybe a stereo replacement to maybe they do just start. Maybe Apple comes out with the Apple equivalent of this automatic thing, a dongle. And it's just like a little add-on. It's just a little thing. Yeah.
Even forgetting the screen. Like, I was imagining you pop the screen off and put a new one. Even forgetting the screen, if they had a Siri-only kind of CarPlay, I would buy that and plug into my car in a heartbeat. Because nothing else works. Nothing else works seamlessly. Like, nothing to the level of, like, the Echo, for example. If I have my phone in the car, Siri, it just doesn't seem super reliable. I've tried things with my watch, and I use that sometimes, but that seems awkward too. And even though I don't need to, I always hold the watch, up to my face, like talking into it, even though it's not required. It's just awkward. Having something I could just plug in, and it was like a next generation Siri that had a lot of car specific smarts in it, I think that would be pretty great.
Bring it on, Apple. We're ready. If you're not going to give us a car. All right, our other sponsor this week is our friends at Linode. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe to serve as the backend for your latest iOS app, consider Linode Cloud Hosting. Linode has been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003. They give their customers free upgrades, and they have 8 global data centers equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs. So you may be wondering why you should bother with Linode. Well, if you've got some kind of shared hosting thing, you don't have any control over most of the things that affect that host. With Linode, you get full root access, so you can have full control over your VMs, you can get clear, precise hourly billing, and there's even a monthly pricing cap. They have add-ons for load balancing, system metrics, and backups, and of course, they have full-time, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year customer support. So, here's the deal. They have a promo code, CoreIntuition20, which on top of all the great stuff I've already described, gets you $20 off. It's effectively 2 free months at their entry-level $10 a month plan. So to learn more, go to linode.com/coreint. Thank you to Linode for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, of course, I use Linode for all my app servers, and I mentioned, I think it was just last week, I said, you know what, we're actually going to finally move more of the podcast stuff to Linode. We've been kind of dragging our feet about that because just kind of in denial that like our old host was just not good enough. And I said that maybe by last week that would be done. I didn't get around to it, but I did get around to it this week. So a few days ago, I moved all our MP3s, which is a lot. I mean, it's gigabytes of audio, moved them all to a new Linode instance, updated the DNS. And so now all our MP3s are served from Linode. I probably still need to tweak some settings in Nginx maybe a little bit and the web server to just really take advantage of it, but it's there and it makes me feel a lot better having the most kind of important stuff for the podcast, the audio, on a host that I trust. So thanks, Linode, for sponsoring the show. Again, that coupon's CoreIntuition20, and go to linode.com/coreint.
Well, Manton, in the realm, we talked about Apple Car in the realm of fantasy, and luckily we have another fantasy for the last couple of years people have had is Apple ever coming out with MacBooks again. They had some stuff, you know, they had like a MacBook One, but a lot of people have been waiting patiently for new MacBook Pros. And I am glad to say that I am among them. I'm not even sure necessarily for me, but I've basically been like telling my wife, please just hold on, just make it work with this Mac for a little while longer. Just, you know, I've got like a Mac on life support. It's like I've had to hack it with it. It's one of these Macs that, to Apple's shame, I think, it's one of these Macs that's one of these, like, you know, 2012 or something MacBooks that has the like famous kernel panics from the GPU. There's people, you know, it didn't affect everybody, but there's like a significant number of people in this world who know exactly what I'm talking about. And there's ways to work around it, trying to like force the Mac to not go into the discrete GPU mode. It's just kind of annoying, but I've like periodically had to rig her computer up to not kernel panic. And I am looking forward to buying her a new Mac. And yeah, so there's a personal, and then there's like the company. I'm happy on the personal level. I get to get at least one new Mac into the house. And then on the company level, well, we always have this reaction when something new and exciting happens for the Mac. We love iOS, but Manton and I are Mac people. We come from Mac stock. And I don't know. It's when the day comes, Manton, that I'm not excited about new Macs, I will truly know that there has been a shift in the world.
Yeah, I don't get quite as excited about new hardware because I think I forced myself to not ignore it, but not get too into it because I don't want to buy anything new. Right. I really try hard to keep my Macs for a few years until it's just obvious that it's been too long. The current one I have, so I do all my work right now on a 13-inch MacBook Pro. Looks like it says mid-2014. I think it was before they upgraded like the trackpad, quote unquote, yep. Upgraded. Yeah. Some people may disagree. It runs great. It's a good machine. And I think I will keep it one more year. I think I will keep it 3 years.
Yeah.
Give or take. Actually, no, I haven't even had it. I didn't buy it when it first came out. So I haven't even had it 2 years yet. So I'll keep it a little longer, another year or two. And I'm sure when the Macs are announced that they will be nice, but I will resist. Because I'm totally fine. My biggest complaint with my Mac right now is that I think I mentioned this before, it fell off the table once. Oh, yeah. And it's got a big dent in it, which is pretty annoying. But other than that, it works perfectly. I'm finally on Sierra. I have no complaints. So I'm excited for new Macs, but it's not personally something I'm going to jump into. I'm still, you know, some developers think I'm crazy that I do all my work on a 13-inch computer. You know, Xcode, Interface Builder, everything. Yeah. But I like it. I like having one size that I take everywhere, to, you know, in my house, into different rooms in my house, to a coffee shop, to co-working. I like working on the same fixed screen size no matter where I go. I think I'm more productive that way, even though it's a little cramped sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get enough disbelief that I work full-time solely on a 15-inch. I actually have, I think, the 15-inch version of the very MacBook you have.
Okay.
That same kind of era. Yeah, still a mechanical trackpad, which, yes, sometimes bugs me. It seems like it's flaking out a little bit, but I also really like that click.
It's very satisfying. And
it's very satisfying. I'm looking at my MacBook right now. I am impressed that even though it's only, I guess that means it's only 2 years old, a little more than 2 years old. Is that right? I guess so.
Probably.
And I've got like a big worn out, I was thinking like, oh, maybe I could sell this thing. I've got like a big worn out mark on my left command key.
Huh.
Like, that just represents how much command keying I'm doing, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting.
Or how forcefully I do it. Maybe I just have a gnarly command key. Well, and what's insane is that I actually am looking at that, and I spend a significant amount of my time using an external keyboard because I prop my MacBook up on a pile of books and then, you know, sit at a desk. But I don't know. That's a little Daniel Jalkut diversion special there for you. But in case anybody was wondering, my command key is worn to the bone, and
time for a new computer.
I need to get a new computer because my command key is worn out. No, I'm excited. You know, I'm really conflicted because I think I might be in the same boat as you when it comes down to it, that I'm happy enough with my existing Mac that it's not worth it for me to upgrade. But there's this other little voice in my head that says, they're not going to update for another 3 years.
Hmm.
You need to buy it now so you get the most value out of it.
Yeah, I don't really, I'm not falling for that.
You're not buying it?
Because I'd rather save the $2,000 or whatever now than, I just don't need a new computer. I'm very curious about what the new one's going to look like. I'm curious about the potential, you know, function key row and kind of craziness that's happening there. But I just don't need a new computer. And I know it's crazy, but.
Well, and it's worth mentioning that usually it's kind of, you can kind of anticipate the news about the new computers being fairly boring. Like you can say, okay, it's probably going to be faster. Maybe it's going to have a nicer screen. It's going to have, you know, backlit keys or something. It's going to have nicer speakers. I don't know, but you don't usually anticipate like a game changer type feature. Like, you know, there are game changers on some level with the iPhone consistently throughout its history. It's like, well, do you want to have Touch ID? You got to get the new phone. Do you want to have, you know, Apple Pay? You got to get the new phone. You want to have, I don't know, you know, way back in the old days, if you want to have GPS, got to get the new phone. And with the Macs, it's often just like, do you want to have the fastest computer available? You got to get the new Mac. But with rumors of stuff like, you know, weird like graphical display on the keyboard, we kind of don't know where Apple's going with it. There's a possibility that they have something planned that will make you go, oh, I don't need a new computer, but I really want that new feature.
Yeah, and as developers, it's possible that that will apply as well. If, like, I don't expect developers can really tap into the new keyboard features, but what if they can? Then it becomes an issue of, I don't need a new computer, but I have a Mac app that I really want to take advantage of this new keyboard. So maybe I need to buy one. It's a business expense. It's not something I wanted to do, but I need to upgrade now so that I can actually test this and I can understand what users are going through. That rarely happens on the Mac,
yeah.
But this could be one of those times.
Now, if it does have developer access, that raises an interesting question because the funny thing is you can have a Mac and theoretically develop for any iOS device because of the simulator.
Right.
And
with some annoying limitations sometimes.
Yes, with some annoying and serious limitations. And also, you know, when it comes down to it, you kind of have to be able to reproduce, you know, the user's own experience, at least on similar devices, to support software effectively. But kind of makes me wonder, like, if they do something like add a visual screen that you have like software control over, is that something they might consider giving you Xcode based simulator for?
Right. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Of course, but maybe not. I mean,
maybe not. Yeah.
Or maybe not right away. Like, they've done a pretty amazing job overall, I think, with the simulator. And even when the watch, you know, came out, being able to run the watch simulator and debug apps, they've done a great job overall with that. But this may be an issue, the thing where they haven't gotten to it. I'd be surprised if there's actually developer access right away. Mm-hmm. It seems like such a major change to introduce an odd one-off right. event that is well after Sierra and well after WWDC. But it would be exciting. I mean, it would be exciting if you could programmatically, you know, Mars Edit fires up and like all of a sudden my function key looks like a blog post icon yeah. or something. I mean, that it would be exciting to be able to do stuff like that. I don't know what this thing is going to look like.
Of course, there's also a chance that the opposite will happen. There's a chance that the Apple's design priorities will eliminate something that we find so useful or we're just used to, that we'll decide that on balance we don't want the new, even, you know. Mm-hmm. So like it could be quite the opposite. It could, whatever they announce could actually encourage me to stick with my MacBook because, for example, I like having, I don't know, proper function keys. assuming yeah. they get rid of them. And, you know, there's a lot of these kinds of things coming up with Apple over the past several years. You know, you had are you willing to give up the smaller form factor on the iPhone? Are you willing to give up the headphone jack? You know, are you willing on the MacBook to give up like all your ports? And it makes the whole like new hotness allure less straightforward when you've got like trade-offs all the time. Like, are you, yes, you're going to get this new exciting fastest machine, hopefully, yet, but we're going to take away your function keys or we're going to take away something.
Yeah. You know, the more I think about that, sometimes I have to remind myself that this is the Mac we're talking about. This isn't the iPhone. And even if there is no like developer story for this, that's not going to stop anyone. Like, there will be a way to customize these function keys. Maybe not through the Mac App Store, but there will be a way.
Mm, I mean, that's interesting.
No, this has to be, right? I mean, there's going to be some weird private API that Apple uses, and developers will, within 24 hours, figure it out and start running hacks and weird experiments. So, I mean, this is going to happen. They're not going to be able to close this off like they would a brand new iPhone 7 feature that is not available to developers for another year. So from that perspective, it could be really interesting what happens. There could be a lot of kind of innovation and random experiments in the developer community because of this.
Estimate for how long until this comes out before we're playing Pong on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's been conflicting rumors too. Like, some original kind of rumors were OLED, I guess, display. But I thought I read something that said e-ink, which, you know, something like e-ink, it's a lot more difficult to play Pong. I don't know. We have no idea, right? And I haven't even been following the rumors very closely. But if there's yeah. any kind of customization like this, developers are going to start playing with it. And it could be that there's some good ideas there.
I am excited to see what's coming. And I guess I have to balance that with that usual trepidation that something I don't agree with will be part of the announcement. But as I said earlier, I'm also just always sort of reassured that Apple's still doing something with Macs. And I don't agree with anybody who thinks like it could be a no-brainer for Apple to like just stop paying attention to the Mac completely. Because I really do think it's still a very viable. It's not only is it a viable product, but the product category, personal computer that sits on your desk or sits on your table or lap or whatever, that whole product category is a category whose usefulness has not been fully explored yet. And, you know, if not companies like Apple figuring out like how to push the limits on what you can do with these things, then who's going to do it? And, I mean, obviously somebody else could, but I'm sort of counting on Apple to recognize that this is still a valid and valuable, you know, product space. And we need these tools. It's like, we can't do all of our work. And it's not just, some people will minimize it and say, well, computers are only necessary for software developers making apps for iOS. And that's just so not true. Like, so many things still, I think. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can do on iOS, but it's just not practical to do it on iOS when you have this superior, you know, product for the task in a personal computer. And I think that that's not only true for a bunch of stuff that has historically happened on Macs, but that there are still things we haven't even discovered that you'll want to do on a Mac before you do it on iOS.
So I've written some posts recently about the iPad as like getting real work done on it. And I think for some professions, the iPad is fantastic for real work. But there is some kind of funny kind of irony with the innovating on the keyboard on the Mac, because I mean, the iPad, of course, doesn't come with a keyboard by default at all. And so there's something kind of interesting about like, okay, we have the Mac, and I agree with you. It's not going anywhere. It's super useful to millions of people. Like, what can we do with the Mac that only a Mac can do? And one of the things is something with a keyboard, because most iPad users don't have a keyboard at all. So yeah, something to this, I think.
Yep. So we'll leave it to Apple to help us guide the way to the next great Mac thing. And hopefully we won't be crying about it in 2 weeks.
Sounds good. Well, thanks everyone for listening to the show this week. Thanks for the feedback. If you have any more, send it to feedback@corent.org or on Twitter @corent. Also check out the jobs board, jobs.corent.org. Look for a job there. Or if you need to hire someone, please post a job there. And you can also find jobs cross-posted to Facebook and Twitter @corentjobs.
Boy, we're just full of links, Manton. One more to add to the list, chat.corent.org. That's where you will find yourself invitation to our chat group on Slack. So hope to see you there, and thanks for listening.